Well, that was something completely different.
Yeah. Tough act to follow, but we're going to, in that spirit.
Tough act to follow. That's right. That's what they say.
In that spirit, we're going to have a very wacky, wild panel discussion. I'm Noam Cohen. I write about Wikipedia for the New York Times for a lot of years, and I recently just finished a book, which I'll mention. Excuse me, ready? Are we okay? Okay. Mention this in the introduction to this issue we're talking about, which has basically been described as post-truth and what Wikipedia has to do with that. Okay. Today marks the 16th birthday of Wikipedia, a lone holdout in the world of big-time internet projects. Think for a moment about what an oddity Wikipedia is.
True.
It doesn't track its users, as is the norm among internet sites, and thus it does not compile a dossier to sell to marketers or to use to create targeted advertisement because, again, nearly unique among information sites, Wikipedia doesn't sell ads to appear next to its articles. Also, Wikipedia isn't dependent on algorithms, in part because it doesn't have a profit motive to keep its users glued to its site. A visitor to Wikipedia begins an informational journey of her own making, link begetting link, until, according to one popular theory, like all intellectual wanderers, you end up with the article about philosophy. Wikipedia's current way of operating wouldn't have been obvious at the beginning, however. Wikipedia.com began January 15, 2001, during an exciting time for internet businesses, the start of the Web 2.0 era, where the idea was to encourage your users to post photos, video clips, reviews, opinions, and then sell advertising to appear next to those posts. The content was free and perhaps even compelling. 2 months before Wikipedia began, there was the launch of the infamous hotornot.com, which allowed people to post, upload photos of themselves to be judged as hot or not by the audience. And in the process, that site showed how quickly a Web 2.0 company could rise to prominence. Jimmy Wales was already running a Web 2.0 company of his own, Bomis, which encouraged users to share web links. And he created an online encyclopedia called Newpedia as another way of promoting so-called user-generated content to sell ads against. Newpedia was edited by an academic named Larry Sanger, who took a very stringent approach to truth. In the first year, barely 20 articles made the cut to be on the site. Newpedia was not going to compete with Hot or Not, that's for sure. When Bomis could no longer indulge the Newpedia experiment, Sanger introduced Wales to the wiki software that allowed anyone to edit the articles, and the floodgates opened, right? 6,000 articles in 6 months, 20,000 articles in the end of the year, but with no guarantee of accuracy or truth. In light of recent concerns about how algorithms at Facebook and Google are mindlessly promoting inaccurate news in the belief that that's what their users want to read, it's interesting to look back at Wikipedia's early years when Google's algorithm promoted Wikipedia content despite its many inaccuracies. Wikipedia was treated by Google as the gold standard encyclopedias because it was the only one really online trying. Encyclopedia Britannica, its online content wasn't free to circulate. Google sent users to Wikipedia, which helped Wikipedia get volunteers, which led to more articles, which led to more volunteers, and so on and so on. Wikipedia was on the march, and had things gone to form, it would have become a profitable Web 2.0 company. But this was a time shortly after the dot-com bubble burst, and Bomis couldn't place advertising on Wikipedia at the start. In 2002, when the idea of advertising was first broached, the community backlash was swift and fierce. No ads were introduced, and a few years later, Jimmy Wales pledged that Wikipedia never would have advertising. At the same time, Wikipedia became more committed to accuracy and sourcing, prompted by a fake news scandal in 2005, which maybe some of you remember, when the respected journalist John Siegenthaler discovered that his Wikipedia article had been vandalized to say that he was a suspect in the JFK and RFK assassinations. He, in fact, was a friend of both of them, and it was very hurtful, right? It was a weird kind of form of vandalism, and it was absurdly untrue. And Siegenthaler was told that the lies only lingered on Wikipedia for so long because so few people actually read it, right? And it was, but that didn't really make much difference to him. It was very painful. Thereafter, Wikipedia emphasized sourcing in all its articles, and the now ubiquitous citation needed template was created at that time. So Wikipedia didn't solve the problem of inaccuracy overnight, but it committed to finding a solution as a community without the distraction of profits. This again separates Wikipedia from the other large projects like Google and Facebook who need to find a scalable algorithmic solution to inaccurate articles. I just finished writing a book called The Know-It-Alls, which is about tech leaders and their algorithms, mm-hmm. about their abundant self-confidence in themselves and in their algorithms. They've wrecked so much disruption on our society in the last decade or so. Men with names like Mark Andreessen, Jeff Bezos, Peter Thiel, Mark Zuckerberg, their contempt for civic institutions like labor unions, local and federal governments, local businesses, newspapers, universities, as well as for concepts like mutual respect, reasoned discourse, and agreed upon truth, has devastated our society, in my opinion, and brought us to our current precarious situation, you know, days before President Donald J. Trump. Again, Wikipedia represents an opposite trend. It is a new civic institution that bolsters community values, promotes collaboration, and works off of a shared belief in truth. Our panelists today are going to use Wikipedia as a leaping off point to explore what has become a pressing issue for our democracy. Are we living in a post-truth age? Should we be cool with that? And if not, how can Wikipedia point us in a better direction? Catherine Maher, here, is Executive Director of Wikimedia Foundation, which is based in San Francisco, and whose mandate is to foster the health and productivity of the many Wikimedia projects. Catherine has been Executive Director since July, after serving as the Foundation's first Chief Communications Officer. Her career before then has been global in scope and devoted to using technology innovation to support human rights, good governance, and international development, including as a founding member of the UNICEF Innovation Team. Tim Wu is a policy advocate who until recently worked at the White House as well, and a Columbia Law professor whose new book, The Attention Merchants, asks what it means for our society when businesses intend to profit by attracting and holding our attention. Fake news is only the beginning of the potential problems that Tim details in his book. Please join me in welcoming them, and we're eager to hear your questions. So does anyone want to jump into that those points? Or?
I guess I don't mind starting, and almost this might be a minor rant, so I'll try it. Well, maybe not at the supreme vermin level, but I'm thinking about Wikipedia, and you probably will like to hear this, which is, boy, can Wikipedia hold its head high at this point in our history? You know, obviously the site has problems, obviously the mission has had problems, but I mean, we have reached a point, I believe, where the web has really hit rock bottom. I think, you know, it is this wonderful, incredible experiment, beautiful idea. And I've been sort of thinking about, like, what happened between 2003 and 2016, like, right, and 17, right now. And that, we live in a time where the web, which was once, as we said, kind of the utopia, that the hope for so many people of how human communications could be, has now somehow turned into a dystopia, almost its opposite. You know, if you just sort of wander around randomly on the web, it's a vast wasteland of empty listicles, celebrity non-stories, random shit designed to get your attention for even a microsecond, videos that load for no reason that you want, just with exceptions, with Wikipedia being one of them, some well-thought-out blogs the other, a few of the old sort of hobbyist sites still around. But in the main, I think that we who believed that the web would be something better have failed and need to look at ourselves carefully and ask, like, what the hell happened? And
well, do you see Wikipedia as leading?
Yeah, I think Wikipedia, I'll talk about that. Okay. I've been just thinking about this lately, and it all comes back to fake news. I think that there was a colossal failure on the part of the web's idealists in the early 2000s to try to create any sort of structures that would protect which was good about the web, structures or institutions that would protect what was good about the web, its earnestness, its openness to anyone, its diversity of content, its voices, its earnest amateurism. And almost nothing done by major institutions to try and ward off what was bad about the trolling, commercialism, the advertising model, which, as you said before, my entire book is about. Sites just designed, like say BuzzFeed, as the epitome to do nothing else other than try to grab your attention, get an emotional reaction, with no other deeper goal than ultimately to sell advertising. The lone exception to that story, the largest exception, is Wikipedia. And I think that's what the lesson of Wikipedia is, which, as you just described, structured itself, took the hard kind of decisions. And at times, Jimmy Wales was mocked for not making billions of dollars. But I think, like, in 10 years, he's going to look great, and the rest of these guys are going to look like they created things that did not last. You know, everyone, I worked at Google or was a fellow there for some time. The sense that, you know, we're different, we can take a totally normal corporate form, but we'll be different because we're googly and, you know, therefore we won't turn to shit, turned out to be wrong. You know, in the long term, I think Google still sort of kept some of its spirit, but structure matters, incentives matter, and sorry for this becoming a rant, but I think we'll look back at this period a little bit like people look back at the 60s and 70s, also the counterculture, and say the only things that survived were not the good vibes, but the institutions who managed to create really hard rules to create public spaces. Public spaces do not preserve themselves. They have to be preserved with fairly strict rules. Otherwise, they turn to horseshit. And I think that's like the biggest lesson of the last 10 years. It's a lesson people learned in the 60s and 70s. And it comes back to this. I mean, I think fake news and post-truth is sort of the epitome of it, where we have a medium which has created a level of untruth which is comparable only to wartime propaganda. So I'll stop there on that mini rant.
Because Catherine was telling me beforehand about being at an event with a lot of prominent mainstream traditional publishers and how they really had a lot to learn from Wikipedia. So maybe she can sort of tell that story.
Yeah, I think it was about the end of November. So the issue of fake news was on a lot of people's minds. And I got invited to an event at Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School for Journalism. And it was an event that is run every year. It's sponsored by the Knight Foundation, which is a major supporter of good journalism globally, in the United States, and has done a lot to launch the careers of many successful journalists and support them, and particularly over the difficult times that the media has had over with the change in business models, with the rise of the internet, and Google. And it is an interesting pairing of two different entities that sort of have mutual dependency on each other, but are not always, they don't always see things from the same perspective. And I was sitting in this room with major publishers, and the session was on transparency, and the whole conversation was around how do we as major publications be more transparent so people trust us more. And one of the publishers was saying one of the first things they did in response to fake news once they realized what an issue it was start a blog to explain the way that the newsroom sausage gets made. And I think my response to that was, if you need to explain it, you're not really actually truly being transparent, right? You're speaking to a bunch of people who are already interested in the way that the Fourth Estate works. You're speaking to essentially insiders. It's like folks like me who end up reading the ombuds people at the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Right, it's true.
And instead, if there's a lesson to learn from what Wikipedia has done, and it was this weird moment where I sort of sat there and I was like, look, I'm not a publisher, but I'm here representing the Wikimedia Foundation, which supports Wikipedia, and I got to tell you guys, this is a really bad situation when I'm sitting in the same room as the New York Times, and you're not trusted, and we are, right? Like, 15 years ago, nobody could have predicted that we were going to be sitting across a boardroom table from each other, and Wikipedia is giving advice on how to build public trust. And yet, that is exactly what we've been dedicated to doing for the last 15 years. Particularly, you mentioned the Siegenthaler event. Wikimedians, the thing that I find so phenomenal about this culture and this community is that you're constantly asking who you're in competition with, and the answer is always yourselves to be better. It is always an aspiration towards the truth. It is always an aspiration towards evolving the projects to be the best that they can be. So we're sitting here and we're having this conversation, and the thing that I kept coming away with is, look, Wikipedia does a couple things really well. Of course, there are the three core policies of Wikimedia: verifiability, no original resource, reliable sources, and we can talk a little bit about all of that. But I think the thing that we don't focus enough on is the role of transparency at every level, policies, structural product, and the accountability that creates to readers and to ourselves. And that is the thing that I see missing from a lot of the conversations we're having about fake news, not just with the media institutions themselves, although I do think they aspire to it imperfectly, but certainly the platforms that have become the intermediaries for the way we view the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting because what it really reminds me of is what Tim was saying about earnestness, that in essence, you know, I used to work at the New York Times, and I definitely know this phenomenon that you really can't tell seasoned journalists, you can't sit there and sort of tell them they made this mistake or they were gullible. There's a lot of built up, self-respect and also feeling that they are professionals. So it almost takes a kind of earnestness to sort of say, well, maybe what did we do wrong? And like you're saying, Wikipedia kind of reassessed a lot of things. And it's like Tim was sort of stating things about rules and structures and being earnest and sort of, I don't know how you quite get that back in the media because it's a for-profit business, it's under assault. I don't know how you can, but I think building a community seems like key to all these values you're talking about. The only way to really fight. So I wonder, Tim, like even looking at the end of your book that you were, you were kind of sort of calling on people to sort of value right. your own time more and do the right thing with your own time. But is it really hopeless to think that we could have a society where our large institutions are respected, have clear
no.
rules?
Right.
And like even I would think about the way even children are unregulated in YouTube videos, or clearly I have young children who their ads that are running on videos that are meant for young kids. And you used to have a feeling as a society that wasn't the right thing to do. So I wonder how are we going to get some grip back on our society?
Yeah. No,
I
think it's a great question. I think it's like the mission of our time. And I'm going to focus less on the media and on the web. Because
okay.
I actually think, I mean, between the two, let's say Facebook and the New York Times,
okay.
I'm just going to say there's a huge yes. gap between
yes.
the level of responsibility going on there. Like, I don't think the Times or Washington Post have been perfect, but I, like, compared to the total shameless disregard for any responsibility, I mean, they've done some things, Facebook, but even the track record or of the sites. And to me, so I think our mission, the mission of, let's say, people who love the web, people who believe in its promise, people like yourselves vested some time into it, is to try to rebuild, recapture, make it better again. And I think that it really does come down to these business models and structures. So, if you go back to this crucial turning point in the early 2000s, Facebook, Google, I'm going to focus on particular because Google was a fairly idealistic place. I don't know if anyone here worked there in the early 2000s and mid-2000s, but, do no evil is their motto. They obviously, like anyone, not anyone, but they certainly had a taste for money, but they were, in their hearts, do-gooders. But they made this massive decision to go the path of advertising-based revenue, become an attention merchant, thinking that, well, we can do this, we'll accept advertising, but it won't corrupt us because we're, we're different, we're better, we're...
Smarter,
we're like, and all of them did, and Google was a leader, and then everyone followed, and then it's like, well, we figured it all out. We can give, everything is going to be free, and nobody even watches the ads anyway, they don't matter, and they're not going to corrupt us. Now, I would have trouble naming an online major platform that's gotten any better over the last couple of years for users as opposed to advertisers. These chickens have certainly come home to roost. And I think fake news is the most strongest example because they set up a model, got trapped in the click world, where your worth on the web is how many clicks you get. Like that has, it makes TV ratings look honorable by comparison. Like a whole world where it's all click-driven has really lowered our society and even our, it's like a threat to civilization, click, click, click. So I don't know if you want to jump in there, but that is like the core root of the fake news problem is click as the profit-driven, click is success. The number of clicks you have success, that is the real core of the problem. And until you solve that, until you have institutions who that's not their entire incentives, I don't know where we get at this.
I was just going to reflect on the fact that it's so much more than fake news, as you were saying. There's a thing that we were looking at recently at the Wikimedia Foundation, where I believe it's a journalist for The Guardian, has gone ahead and has taken out advertisements for the Wikipedia page on the Holocaust. Because if you search for whether or not the Holocaust happened right now on Google, one of the very first results you find is from a white supremacist organization that denies the Holocaust. And so this journalist has gone ahead and she's actually taken out AdWords ads that say, read this, the Holocaust happened, and link to Wikipedia. And it's very strange for us because we certainly don't invest in that sort of CEO. We don't buy ads for Wikipedia. And so we're going, well, this is an interesting differentiation. We've never seen this before. Mm-hmm. But it is so much more fundamental than the question
right.
of news. News certainly is an issue. But when we
right.
start getting into these places where you can have entire versions of history that are different
right.
based on the algorithmic stream you're sitting in, it starts to erode the common fabric of our conversation.
Yeah, it's
right.
interesting. Also, in some ways, you wouldn't even take an ad out for the New York Times because the New York Times never really writes an article. The Holocaust happened, and here's what it was like. It's not really their job. And in some ways, in this kind of individualistic world we live in with the web, you almost need these polls like Wikipedia to say, this is what the Holocaust is, and here's what U.S. is, and here's how bills pass. All these kind of like important guidance and just living in the world without... without any context, sort of the necessary context,
right.
I guess.
The thing that, one thing There are so many things that scare me, but one of the things that, you know, one of the first things that I did in sort of the second half of November was draw up a list of the things that I worry about for the health of Wikimedia going forward. And I have to say that, you know, there are certain things that are just sort of fundamental to the way that we operate and exist, and it is around things like protections of safe harbor and protections from intermediary liability, and these are sort of policy protections that allow for not just Wikimedia, but a number, almost every major website within the United States to be successful. I worry a little bit less about these because there's such a common vested interest in ensuring these protections continue to exist for the future, but they're consistently being eroded through various court decisions and the like, and potentially, you know, we always hear rumors of around legislation that would look to seek to roll some of these back. But the thing that actually scares me the most and is around the erosion of our common discourse around what truth and reliability is, right? Because Wikipedia relies on secondary sources, and secondary sources are only as good as the creation of those sources, which rely on access to information in the first place. So as I look around and I think about the health of the Fourth Estate, this is actually so critical because in some ways we're just a layer on a layer. And I, you know, then that sort of gets into the question of what is fake news and what's reliability. And one thing I love about the way that Wikimedians have determined this over time is they look at the characteristics of sources as opposed to the sources, you know, the names of the sources themselves or the outlets. And I think that that's a really healthy way of doing it. But this is something that is so frightening, is if we cannot actually access truthful information or decide on what truthful information is, how do we how do we build a record? How do we continue to support
the I mean, do you look at something like MOOCs as a threat as well, where if you sort of take universities and make them, you know, not really have professors who, and it's more just about classrooms that are remote, that's another threat? Because, you know, academics are also the ones who are creating these records that are useful now, and it's another threat because it's sort of not appreciating the kind of things that are created by institutions.
Well, maybe I can say something to that. I'm a fan of the writings of John Stuart Mill, and, you know, I have some belief, most of us probably do, in the idea that truth is discovered through discussion and you know, presentation of both ideas. And I don't think Wikipedia has ever stood for the idea that, you know, one guy figures out the truth and then tells everyone it. I mean, but Google and Facebook, some of the web properties took that, you know, that presupposes good faith in the people that are advancing different viewpoints. Right, that is the key difference between like a Millian or Holmesian discourse, is it presupposes good faith. There's a different kind of discussion, and you know, someone who's a media historian, myself, really the word propaganda is important, I think. And maybe other people will disagree on whether fake news is propaganda. I understand propaganda as bad faith argumentation. You know, that what its fundamental affect is it uses technique which, you know, most obviously lying or making up stuff that are designed to or outrageously shocking emotional content. Atrocity propaganda is what was typically used, or you know, character attacks, things that are you know, outside of this boundary of good faith discussion. And that's the layer I think we're missing. It goes back to your secondary sources, where everything, including propaganda and regular source, propagandists and regular sources are weighed, then you end up in the middle, which is still heavily skewed, right? And so anyway, I think
Wikipedia is pretty good about not letting propagandists, you know, be treated equally with other other sites. And
the problem is everybody else.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to get to. I mean, I guess I'm trying to call on everyone. I think the mission of us the next 5 years is to, you know, try to export some of the norms of Wikipedia to more parts of the web. I know it's challenging. I mean, I don't know where you start. But imagine if you actually had a good faith version of Facebook, like that, whose incentives were public, were actually like getting people to somehow, you know, build community in a way that was not just about trying to figure out how to sell you shit. You know, like if that was their motives at a deep level, it would be a much different kind of site. And there is at every single one of these websites something quite beautiful. You know, Google, information, you know, the world's information organized. You know, Facebook, finding your old friends. But then they have all become corrupted. Not completely, but slightly,
I guess my theory from my book is that it really relates to artificial intelligence and the idea of scaling. So I think Facebook and Google will think we're doing great things if they publish where to vote and they go, look how many people voted, you know, because we tweaked our algorithm to say where your polling location is. Or, you know, there were similarly, like Mark Zuckerberg frequently talks about how internet access is equivalent to lifting people out of poverty, like a mathematical formula.
Yes, but not Facebook access.
What? No, not, right.
No, important distinction to make.
Even that limited access that he's promoting, he says will lead to 1 in 10 people being lifted out of poverty. I have no idea what that's like based on, but it's, so these are things that are scalable and based on AI, and the things you're talking about, Tim, are human and are based on like a good faith discussion. And I mean, Catherine, can you explain, what are some of the challenges? How does Wikipedia keep being a community that doesn't devolve? And you're saying it requires a lot of work for the foundation because there are obvious problems with Wikipedia. It does not reflect reality. Its articles are very skewed in terms of white men and the West, and this is a real
and comic
challenge.
Book stories. Yeah. Although I kind of like the fact you can like miss 100, you can like read up Daredevil and see what happened the last 10 years in like incredible detail. But anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, I think the classic example of this is the new Princess of Wales. I'm sorry. Thank you. I wanted to say Kate Middleton, but I wanted to use her proper title, which I apparently don't know.
The Duchess of Cambridge.
Yeah. The classic example of this is the Duchess of Cambridge's dress at her wedding, right? Which is that there was this big discussion, do you keep it, do you not keep it, is it notable? And Jimmy Wales is like weighing in saying, guys, you have an article for every like Linux OX that has ever existed. So yeah, I think the dress is notable in this instance when it's worn by the future Queen of England. I mean, the foundation doesn't, as everybody here who's a Wikimedian knows, the foundation doesn't set editorial policy. Mm-hmm. Community members do. And one of the things that I've always loved about Wikimedia is that it is an organic entity. It grows and evolves in response to stimuli in the ecosystem around it. And so it means that we can continue to evolve towards a better version of ourselves, or we will, you know, or we face pressures on us that are shaping and fundamental. I think that what the foundation can do is to provide support for voices in the community that are bubbling up, that are advocating for greater equity and representation, making sure that those things are available, making sure that policies are in place to support people, making sure that harassment isn't something that exists in Wikimedia the way that it does on other internet platforms, and making sure we don't backslide on values, right? And so one of the things that Tim mentioned was earlier around the impetus to click and why that matters. So Facebook has, I think, it has been reported that they have something that is essentially akin to a God metric, which is like the one metric that they look at to see how successful is Facebook, and it is time spent on site.
Yeah, it's so low. Right?
Which is so weird, because sort of taking that to its nonsensical,
just low, you know?
Nonsensical conclusion, right. You know, and I don't know if you've seen the ads for Facebook Lives that are up everywhere these days. I'm supposed to walk down the street with Facebook on, I'm broadcasting myself all the time, you know, it's like something in a super sad true love story. Like, it's just out of science fiction. Taken to its logical conclusion, we're supposed to spend 24 hours a day on Facebook and not sitting here, interacting, having conversation, thinking about the world. You know, Wikimedia doesn't have that. And we've had conversations, this may be not widely known, we don't know how many people use Wikimedia every month. We have no idea. We can guess, we can estimate, we can sort of reverse triangulate on a bunch of different data, but we don't track individual users. And there have been conversations at time about how could we serve people better if we did, because we might be able to find improved pathways to learning. We might be able to understand where we're not serving communities around the world. We might be able to design products in ways that actually surface information and allow people to find what they're looking for faster. But if we do that, what other incentives will that create?
That's right. Right.
How will that change the fundamentals of who we are? And so at the foundational level, certainly serving and supporting the community in order to enable it to create and curate knowledge more effectively, to support underrepresented voices, we can do these things, and we do these things through community support and programs, but also making decisions not to make decisions, I think, is really critical.
Very
and being
sound,
a backstop for
very
those
profound.
Values.
You're saying the incentives can be really wrong like that if you don't watch out for it.
Right.
You can get sucked in. That's kind of
no. It is a story of sorry to
no.
But it's a story of the history of many forms of media. They have these often golden ages. If you look at say radio and television, whether the golden age perceived of radio and television was always right before ratings technologies got better. You know what I mean? And I'm serious. There's a certain softness that makes a huge difference. Mm. As soon as, look, I like data as much as anyone else, but we have almost dangerous tendencies to fixate on numbers and then make that like that's gotta be everything. And so like TV in the late 50s was ruined by, you know, better ratings technology where they knew exactly. And that's when they started canceling all the shows that were, you know, what people thought were so great about TV, like CNN and Ed Murrow's show, because they weren't. They replaced Ed Murrow's show with something called How Well Do You Know Your Wife? you know, like that was the moment. And I think the web took its turn to the worst, frankly, when it adopted the advertising model with like, oh, it's not going to ruin us. And then it became about clicks and or time on site or whatever number like that. And I think you're exactly right. That there's something, you know,
unless you really, truly are exceptional.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that to say exceptional in the sense of having some sort of greater purpose. It's just that if you accept out and you are the exception to the rule,
right,
then it allows you to be exceptional. But none of us are immune from the same
right.
pressure.
That's right.
Unless we choose to deliberately remove ourselves.
It's a good point. It's all like teaching to the test. You know how people, you know, the difference between real education and teaching to the test. It's like once you set up this kind of quantitative metric that you aim for, and look, metrics can be useful sometimes, but they can also destroy good institutions. And I think clicks destroyed the web. That's my bottom line. And time on site,
scalability and automation. And I guess the other key word I really like is the idea of earnestness, because even it can seem laughable or, you know, very earnest to say we're going to really have an edit-a-thon and we're going to focus on this category and. You know, but I think all that effort, what it says behind it, and also it really, I think it does make a difference if it keeps spreading. But it can be looked at, I'm sure it is widely thought of as like, what a joke, you're going to try to encourage this area to be edited, and it can't really make a dent in something as massive as Wikipedia. But I think that earnestness is really good. We can take questions. You have a question? Sure. Let's, sure. Oh, is there a mic to pass around? Oh, is there one? Is there a microphone?
Where's the microphone?
Don't know. Oh.
I understand you, my
really?
Mic,
Danny. Oh, here, there's back. Okay. Oh, okay. So just speak up. Okay.
We have a mic here.
Good. Okay.
Catherine, I'm confused because you said moments ago that we don't really know how many people are reading us, but I read the signposts regularly and I see statistics about page views, mobile page views and traditional page views and. It seems like there's a lot of data, and
sure.
I'm confused
so
on what you're saying.
We're no way anti-data. As Tim was saying, data can be incredibly useful. We do know how many page views we get. That's built into the way that the sites work and the analytics that we have. We also know how many unique devices visit Wikimedia. The difference is we don't track individual users. So Tony, when you access Wikimedia or any site, we don't know if you are coming, if you on your laptop are the same person that's coming on your mobile phone, so we're not tracking you across the sites, we're not tracking you across language. We know that so many devices visit English Wikipedia, so many devices visit Malayalam Wikipedia, so many devices visit German Wikipedia, and then we can sort of estimate roughly, based on those numbers, how many unique devices visit us every month in the world, and it's somewhere around a billion. So it's a really big number, but we just don't know if that's a billion people or 500 million people who really love Wikipedia, right? And I think that that's something that we've deliberately chosen not to do, because the moment we know more about individual users, we can start divining all sorts of information about them. And we've had these conversations and said, this isn't where we want to go.
So you don't have a God stat for Wikipedia?
We don't have God view, no.
No God view, no. Okay. Cool, someone else has questions? Or someone behind you and then you next, I guess, yeah. Yeah, sure, go, and then we'll go next, yeah.
So my name is Yuri. Even though I work for Wikimedia, this is a personal question, just a disclaimer. We have been talking about algorithmic result sets as well as curated result sets. In your opinion, and possibly the community at large, what should the foundation be more concentrated, what should the users be more concentrated on? Should we strive to create even more curated content, or should we go partially into algorithmic of aggregating that content to provide a better answers to some of the questions that our users might position?
You want to pass over there and you want to answer?
No, that's your question.
You both can go. You next.
You know, one of the things, Yuri, that I think we found, and I hope you'll agree with, is that that's a conversation to have in dialogue with community members, right? The foundation can work to help build tools that use machine learning in order to assess how the quality of content. That's something we've already done. We the way that we have done this in just even in the recent past is do so in dialogue with community about what helps community present information. So one of the most controversial things that, that the foundation did recently was experiment with being able to allow people to curate their own lists of content and sort of have their own reading lists on mobile devices. And there were a number, as it turns out, there were a number of different issues with that. And so we rolled it back. And I think that that's the conversation we constantly need to have in the open, in public, with people who are responsible for creating the content itself, is how do we improve the presentation of information? One thing that, that I feel so strongly about is I never would want us to lose the effect of serendipity, right, in terms of learning pathways on the site. I think Wikipedia would be a very different place if at the end of every article you were told what to read next versus versus having the opportunity to continue to discover.
Can I reflect on that question just a little bit more broadly? I think one of the greatest questions facing our civilization over the next 10, 20 years is like, what is it important to have humans do and what do you have the robots do? And we're facing it at different places in different parts of our society. I was just thinking, for example, of cooking, eating, as a random thing. I mean, right now, if you want, you can, you know, just buy a TV dinner and put it in a microwave and, you know, essentially have no role in it. But the food tastes terrible. Or you can, you know, go all the way towards, you know, you make your own noodles and your own whatever, and it tastes better, but it takes up all your time. And I think we are in this, like, struggle in all kinds of areas, whether it's journalism, whether it's the web, our media, to try to understand more, as with cooking, more almost more intelligently or more sensitively, when do you use robots? Not just because it's neat or you can do it, but because it like doesn't destroy something about what really matters, which is human connection, right? And
so
and I think that's
life?
A really really like deep question. And I think what's happening is like, the media is and the web, our communications media. We didn't have this question 100 years ago. Robots couldn't do anything. But this is like the hard question for us to get that balance right. It's going to be neither extreme.
I think one of the things that, that I sort of reflect on is that I think one that Wikipedia proves that if you respect your users, they'll make good decisions, right? And what I mean by this is the sort of idea that we can use robots to tell people what it is that they want to read comes from almost a place of, I don't want to say paternalistic, but some form paternalistic,
yeah,
I've gotten,
that's the point of my book, yeah.
A paternalistic sort of assumption that I know better than you do about the way that you want to consume information or engage with information. And one of the things that Wikipedia assumes is that you're smart enough to figure it out for yourself, right? Like, use good judgment. Check, you know, does it says citation needed, you should probably check the citations, right? The information's all there, it's all transparent. If you have questions, you can dig into it. You know, use good judgment. That's trusted enough. And if your life depends on it, probably you should, you know, go to a secondary source.
Right. Well, there's big differences between technologies which actually enable what it means to be human, you know, like tools or like a knife or, you know, things like that, and ones which kind of shut down our humanity and make us less part of
pasta
the real key.
Versus,
and there's something very deep there, and I know we're, but I think it matters to like Wikipedia it's like trying to figure out where is that thing that is essentially human that matters, that gives, I mean, Wikipedia has a human feeling to it, right? I mean, it is like, with all of its flaws, it gives you something to grab onto.
Imperfect.
Yeah, sorry, I know there's another question over there.
Yeah. Were you had a question there?
Yeah.
So disregarding the current incoming administration, which probably has no interest in this whatsoever, do you think that there, if platform cooperativism, cooperativism is like an alternative model for, like, I guess, goodness on the internet, do you think that governments or international organizations have a responsibility towards legislating cooperative platforms into existence or encouraging them? And if so, how do you think such a thing could be done?
That's, I guess it's a question for me because I was just in government. So I was, last day in the White House was on Friday, and I faced a lot of, when you're in government, you face a lot of time trying to understand what government is good at or not good at. I don't think government is good at trying to guess what the future should be and make it so. I think they're much better at punishing bad things. You know what I mean? As opposed to saying, you shall do this. I think they're much better at saying, thou shall not do this, sort of Ten Commandments style. That's my general philosophy. And so even though some ideal, platonic ideal of government could stipulate what the ideal platform would be, I think that would be challenging. On the other hand, the internet was a government project, but it was funded by government. So there's a subtle difference between dictation and funding. And I think there can be a lot more support and funding for public-spirited spaces on the most important medium in our times, the web. I mean, there are basically none or very little. When you can think about the internet itself, which was funded by government, television, which had public broadcasting and all kinds of support, radio, you know, all these things, there was support for publicness and pressure to be public. And there's been this wrongful idea in government that's like, oh, you know, we can have normal for-profit corporate business models and get all the goodness and publicness we want, and I think we got to get over that. I don't know if the next administration has that view. The incoming, in fact, no one the hell knows what they're just like another, their metric is different. Their metric is time on site. You know, the Trump administration is, how much time do I spend reading about their crazy fights about whatever? That's their main interest, is like winning the attention war from Facebook, as far as I can tell. So, yeah, that's a different story.
You want to ask a question?
Hi, Kira Gaunt. I wanted to invite you to talk about systemic bias a bit more, especially in the meat space part of the community. And I ask that because I'm the person up here saying use the mic, and it's not just for the live feed. It's for in the back of the room, you can't hear as much, or people can't hear who's talking. And this anonymity works against people of color and marginalized groups. It has us not feel like we're part of a, you know, most people don't know some of the terms that we're using if they're new here. And so I even want to ask you about these kind of meetings, that this one-to-many kind of communication, there's no like communal sharing in the main spaces. This is my first time to one of the Wikipedia days, but I'm just saying, just from the time that I've been here and at other kinds of social media events, I'm a TED fellow, this repeatedly happens where we don't think about how to organize the space so that everybody's included. Huh. And I mean the physical, interactive space. So yeah, I'm wondering what's been going on in the past. Like, how do we... I know that one of the answers is, I do it. You know, I inspire that. But I also would love to hear your thoughts.
I was going to say maybe Richard wanted to talk about it and how this event goes, because I mean this is obviously a panel discussion, which is by definition few to many. I think other events I assume are much more interactive. That's my memory of going to other Wikipedia events, but that's something Richard or Catherine want to explain more about how.
I don't know if I can explain. I think I might be able to offer a reflection or two. I know you asked about the meat space, but I would just start by acknowledging that I think everyone in this room, if they're not already aware, should be aware that Wikipedia and the Wikimedia projects are a mirror held up to the world. And so our biases are the world's biases, our biases are historical biases, our biases are biases of legacy and discrimination and representation. And it is incumbent upon each of us, when we look at the Wikimedia vision, which is a world in which every single human can freely share in all knowledge, that requires the participation and the representation of all people. And if I can say one thing strongly and emphatically, it is that I believe that at the foundation, we believe that to be true, and we want to create the enabling environment for that to be represented. One of the first things, and I'll just again speaking for the foundation before addressing, I think perhaps your larger point, although I don't know that I have answers to it, is that one of the things that we've been talking about is in order to represent that community, we must embody that community. Because the perspectives, I was reading something just the other day about how technology companies make decisions, and it's a sort of widely known fact that lower income communities, there's a greater preponderance of Android devices than iPhones. And most tech companies focus their development on iPhones because they're a higher revenue market, And guess who makes, guess who owns them, and guess who works at tech companies, right? It is primarily young, white, male, cisgendered, heteronormative individuals, right? Which is not to say that they aren't probably perfectly lovely and well-intentioned, it's just that they can't see the biases that they can't see, or they can't see the biases when they're not reflecting on them. And so I think that one of the first things that we have to do at the Wikimedia Foundation is to work to embody the communities that we want to serve. And I can tell you right now, we don't do that yet. We have a long way to go, but it is something that we recognize that we need to do. And that, you know, those sort of deep fundamental structural changes, I do believe then start to have impacts on the way that we think about funding, on the way that we think about organizing, on the way that we think about conversations, on the language we use, the places we have those conversations. You know, sitting here in the body that I embody, I am not the perfect person to answer those questions, and I fully recognize that. And so it does require bringing more people in. I don't know that I have more to say than that.
I'm not asking for answers.
Yeah. No, it's good, but I'm glad you raised the question.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, that's how the microphone works. Sorry, Paco, on Wikipedia. I kind of came in a little late, so I'm sorry if this question was already addressed in the beginning. We live in this weird kind of paradoxical world where not only do a lot of humans believe in absolutes when it comes to data, but also the confusion between like the scientific method of processing data and what opinion is. And for example, we have a giant sign here that says, should we trust Wikipedia and the difference between high quality and low quality articles? When I saw the title that this was the post-truth panel leading up to and potentially the current administration, we've had this like muddiness of what is fact, what is opinion, and that's been this huge public discourse of, which is where we got the term fake news from, of that even if you have empirical information, that doesn't mean people are gonna absorb it as information, because essentially there's such information and dialogue overload that no one can process it, and therefore everything can be swayed over with the right person's social engineering. So my question is there anything the Wikipedia Foundation and local communities can do into trying to help alleviate that sort of don't take Wikipedia for its word and do research on it and help out and stuff? Or do you think this is like a general United States and global public problem that we just have to water out in the next like 5+ years?
So we spoke a little. Do you want to talk about the Wikipedia part? Or I'll say a little bit about it. I mean, we did speak about this a little earlier, and I think.
Do I? Oh, no.
Oh, sorry. Can I answer a little bit? Or do you want to take
questions?
I do think it comes a lot to business models and the incentives of the web, the main actors on the web. So, as someone who's interested in the history of media, there are periods like this, but they tend to be during wartime. Like the most, you have intense fake news during wartime because especially where the existential the existence of a country is at threat, where the media and the governments will throw everything to one side and say we will say anything or do anything in order to win this war. World War I is a terrific example where the British really pioneered intense fake news propaganda style stuff. But then there tends to be like a recovery from it. And the weird part is we're always at some kind of war, but we're not in this major existential war. It's not even the Cold War, yet there's, there's sort of social war, I guess, going on, where we have levels of propagandizing and bad faith writing and insanity. And how we recover from that, I think that takes more than Wikipedia. I mean, we've said before, I think Wikipedia its methods are instructive to a lot of groups, but I really do think there needs to be a widespread revolt, and hopefully we're seeing it, against fake news and propaganda, and and some responsibility on the part of every single organization that is a media organization. Or I was thinking, if you're not asking really hard questions, if you're even vaguely in the media, you're almost certainly doing something unethical right now. And I just hope that in some ways ethics and morality come out, or otherwise just things get worse and worse. So that's where I think we are.
Comment. Sorry. I feel you've talked about how is this going to change. I don't think anyone brought up about our young people. We have created a platform of communication where humanity was never brought into, and I think the only people that can solve it is our young people, and that comes with education. And I think where this all has to fall is back into, you know, schools, the way we were taught penmanship. And it's compassion, humanity, that has to be taught globally, because we've created a tool for communication, and I don't know where it's going to go unless our young people can change it for us.
You want to, can you get the mic over there? Or you want to, let's give them the mic if you can, over there.
Can the people in the back, in fact, hear us now? I still feel a little sensitive to that. And I should apologize. I've been on a ranting mood. I think because I've just been in government for so long and not able to say anything that it's all coming out. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Noah. I'm a journalist with Vice News. And one of the things that I've had a lot of issue reconciling with is the degree to which Facebook has kind of monopoly power over the way people consume media more broadly. And we can discuss all of the different ways in which you can create controls and technologies or community norms and introduce them into Facebook and other social media services and other areas on the internet and make things better. But fundamentally, it seems like there's sort of a political and economic problem at the root of it, which is the amount of economic power concentrated within a handful of companies. And so absent technological, I mean, or even including technological reforms or advancing community norms that can make those spaces richer and better, they're still at the end of the day are like a set of incentives that are misaligned with community values of truth and honesty and transparency. And, you know, I'm not asking for what is the solution, but what does a way forward look like to you guys?
Well, isn't it kind of implied in your question that if Tim was saying that government's strongest when it can say no to things is that there should be breaking up these large monopolies? It just seems sort of self-evident that it is not in anyone's interest for Facebook and Google to have such control over advertising. Their being so large creates all these bad incentives, like you're saying. And, you know, localized web would be much better in every way, including aligning the incentives, right? So I don't know why, Tim, I don't know right. How you feel about that, but and Catherine, but it seems like breaking up big monopolies would be among the easiest things to do to stop these bad incentives and to create much more competition and a better system. And you look back, even the breakup of Microsoft, you know, or the reining in of Microsoft was vital to having Google arrive. And it just seems natural that we're losing our way. I think that these companies like Facebook have learned that they're going to acquire anyone who could possibly rival them. They spend an incredible amount of money buying any sort of, you know, startup that could become right. a rival, and they're not living the same. They're not making the same mistakes that Microsoft did. They're much more aware to like become dominant. So, I mean, it seems like that's a major, obvious thing government could do. I don't know that the Donald Trump government will do, but
unpredictable. Yes, yeah. The one line answer to that is the antitrust laws to be more explicit mm-hmm. about. I think in the United States, the speech environment in the United States is because of the way this country is largely determined by economic structure. And there's a tendency to sort of be 20, this is my book, The Master Switch. 10 or 20 years, there's a new communications technology comes along, breaks everything open, and then it comes back together in these large sort of structures. And we are at a period where the internet's now about, popular internet's about 20 years old, and you see a sort of hardening. And the question is will or can something new break through, or have, you know, a couple, say three or four or five companies kind of locked it up? And if so, what does that mean for the speech conditions? Locked it up with their view towards speech, which is essentially we are a pipe and whatever happens, happens. And that, that is the question, and I think it's a question for government. Does government, I would put it a little differently. I mean, one, you can break up companies. You can also say, does government make it possible for the next thing to destroy what's there? And I think that's a really important role. And that when I worked in antitrust, that was like, do we make it possible for the next Google, the next whatever, to destroy the earlier Google? Well, letting Facebook buy everything doesn't exactly make that happen.
I ask the question, because you spend a lot more time thinking about this, is you just referred to these companies as a pipe, and there's always the argument that you don't necessarily need to break them up, but you could regulate them like they were the pipes, like they were the utilities.
Yes.
I'm interested in where you come down on that as you think about the conditions you just described.
Right. Well, I spent a lot of
my... I'm not advocating necessarily.
No, I spent a lot of my career on net neutrality, and so I wouldn't... would be...
it all lies in what you mean by the word regulation, because I also know the long history of regulation. If it's done wrongly, it becomes career protection for a monopolist. The AT&T monopoly was regulated, and they were there for 70 years. So the question is, do you want Facebook for the next 70 years or not? There's some real danger. On the other hand, I mean, it depends what you mean by regulation. There's also, this is getting a little lawyerly, but there's also like saying, okay, you've gotten big enough, you can't buy anybody. You know, Instagram could have been a disruptive threat to Facebook, for example. Why that merger went through, I have no clue. I wasn't responsible for it. You know, it could be threatening Facebook, and there could, but ultimately also come back to this idea that maybe the moral revolution of the web and a more public, like, someone here, we need to take back some of these things. Someone should take over Twitter and dedicate it to public purpose. There's my first target. Twitter has no business as a, I mean, Twitter makes no sense as a for-profit company. You know what, I know people are trying, they make no sense.
I thought Peter Thiel might buy it, I've heard. So, or not.
No, there was an effort, I think, conversation among media companies, is could you make this as a public entity? I'll admit that I was really fascinated by its valuation and how that really puts that out of reach. But
okay, I think that's all our time, but thank you everyone for being here. And thank you.